Good evening. Let me know if this needs to be adjusted. Thank you for having us here. Tom and I are friends from Grand Rapids, and he does mostly work in the hospital setting with the hospital patients, and my practice has been more in the outpatient setting. And so we were asked to come to present to you. And in 2010, I was here last and enjoyed being here. I thank you for having me back again. And I hope that what we say together will be helpful. We look forward to your questions, so please feel free to think of your questions, write them down, or whatever you need to do, and ask them. We'd like dialogue when we're finished. I hope that in this presentation that it doesn't come across as a lecture. What we really would like to do for you tonight is hopefully to give you a new insight or a new way to think about the items that we present. So it's not a medical lecture so much, but a way to understand how people find themselves in the situations they're in. And I think that there is a very powerful physical element, and there's a powerful spiritual element, but there's also a very powerful social or community element. So we'll start with the title here. We're talking about addictions. We're going to cover two addictions mostly, but I want you to think in your mind that there's other addictions that fit this model very well. We read at home recently in the Insight Into, a special edition about addictions that came out, I think, in January. And there's a series of meditations that describe the process of addictions and how that can be a battle. So we want to think about this in broad terms and not specifically focus on just the addictions that we cover tonight. So we'll talk first about alcohol addiction, and then we'll cover a second addiction using this outline. Is that picture familiar? Apparently not. It's a park in Lethbridge. Has anybody been there before? Maybe somebody will recognize it. So, to begin with, I would like to talk about the basis of the descriptions of alcohol in the biblical setting. Like all of the blessings that we are given, there is an appropriate use of the blessing and there is an inappropriate use. And so I think we should start on the positive side when we talk about alcohol. And remember that there's many indications in the Bible that there is a blessing associated with its use. For example, God often promised, and the references are up there, that if the covenant was kept, that wine would be given, that the alcohol could be used in a positive way. And on the opposite side, if there was disobedience, that this would be the place where the punishment would rest, that they would work in their vineyards, but they would not taste of the vine. And that was, there's several references you can see where that was brought out. And also there's several occasions where God specifically cursed Israel's enemies, again touching that one important part of their life, which was their drink. So how is it so prevalent in the time of Israel? We hear in the Bible many times the word winepress. And for those of you who've been in Israel, you've probably seen them. But the Bible land was actually a good place to have a winepress because they had a lot of limestone, which was easy for them to carve, but also it was waterproof so that they did not lose the precious wine. So there was a treading floor, which the workers would tread the wine. And then there was a series of canals that would bring them to a storage place, and they used woven fibers, or sometimes thorn bushes woven together, to act as a filter. And then the yeast that was in the skin of the grapes would begin the process of fermenting the wine. And in a couple of days, depending on how it needed to be prepared, it was ready. And it was sealed in the earthen pots. Or if they needed what the Bible calls vinegar, then it was left unsealed. So this is actually a picture of a wine press, and this is actually in Jezreel, thought to be possibly even Naboth's vineyard. And there are many such excavations that show that this was a common part of everyday life. God allowed the Levites to receive the wine as part of their payments. And there is even a reference in the Old Testament where when the Jews were traveling to the festival of the first fruits, the feast of the first fruits, that they were traveling long distances, and so that specific instructions were given that they may purchase what they need when they arrive rather than to carry it with them. And it mentions that wine was appropriate to purchase when they participated in this feast. And also there were several examples where wine was specifically poured out over sacrifices as a demonstration of the symbolism. Here's another beautiful wine press, almost in its original state. This was in the Philistine city of Ashkelon. This was around the time when Nebuchadnezzar took the Philistines into captivity. We also know that in the civilizations that followed Israel, in the Romans' days as well, it was a big part of their economy was to produce the wine. And that helped support their armies. So wine was also appropriate for feasts and weddings, celebrations. The Song of Solomon reference says he brought me to the banqueting house, which literally means the house of wine. And also there are New Testament examples. For example, the wine was the comparator to demonstrate the riches of the blood of Christ that was shed. So it was the analogy that was chosen. And Christ also speaks of longing for the time when he would drink wine with his people in his Father's kingdom. So we should not look at wine as if it's completely condemned in the Bible. But on the other hand, there are many more indications where wine was appropriately warned about its misuse. And so we're all familiar with the example of Noah in Genesis, but we also think of Lot, which happened soon after. And also I thought it was intriguing when I researched this that it never speaks once that the Israelites were given wine or strong drink during the 40 years that they wandered in the wilderness. So I think there's also many texts that you can research that show the misuse of strong drink. There's even a word, shikar and shakar. I'm not sure I'm pronouncing it correctly, but the root word for drunkenness comes from the word strong drink as opposed to wine. This is a painting from Rembrandt of Belshazzar's feast. And the Bible makes it clear that the bringing out of the gold and silver vessels occurred after the drinking of the wine, after the tasting of the wine. So again, poor decisions being made and ultimately the loss of the kingdom. This was an interesting article I found written in 1889. It speaks of that flood of misery that came after the original flood. The quote in there, you may read it, it says that Noah survived one flood only to bring in or be the source of another. That is the flood of grief that follows the use, or we should say perhaps the misuse, of the crimson fluid. And it is true that many hundreds of years later, we still are fighting with the misuse of alcohol. And the quote there, today the world is drenched from the accursed stream, in every land the juice of Noah's press is drank. We don't know who the author was. The author signed his name Drunkard or Dr. Unger. So, but that was in the 1800s. So now from the medical perspective, we're going to briefly summarize the medical effects of alcohol. I think most of us know these. We'll be sharing these same effects with the children tomorrow when we do this presentation tomorrow. So of course, the alcohol starts in the mouth and the effects already are found there. The fact is that daily drinking of alcohol doubles our risk of having head or neck cancers. This is because of the chronic burning or irritation of the mouth and the throat. It moves from there down the esophagus where that same damage occurs. Then it hits the stomach where only a small amount is absorbed. But again, the aggressive nature of the alcohol on the lining of the stomach can break down the ability of the stomach to absorb important vitamins. We already see this in patients who have had years of use of alcohol. From there, the majority of the alcohol is absorbed in the intestines, and then goes immediately into the bloodstream, and there it has a direct effect on the red blood cells. The red blood cells become sticky, so that they tend to want to clump together and form blood clots. And in addition, they cannot carry oxygen as well. This is the chronic effect of alcohol on the traveling red blood cells. In addition, the white blood cells, which are the infection-fighting cells, also are inhibited. So we have a general decrease of the body to fight off infections. From there, the blood circulates back to the heart. The effect of alcohol on the heart depends on the dose. Of course, a small amount of alcohol, especially the chemicals that are found in red wine, have been proven to be healthy for the heart. But too much alcohol causes a weakening of the blood vessels and of the heart muscle. It causes the heart to beat harder and faster. It changes the heart rhythms. And then another effect that I'm sure you're aware of is that it opens up the blood vessels, so it brings the blood closer to the skin. That effect produces the feeling that you're warm when actually you're colder. It brings the warm blood to the surface, but the heat evaporates. So it causes problems regulating body temperature. From there, all the blood goes to the liver. Once it's in the liver has the job to take the toxins out of the blood, and so it has to break alcohol down. The speed at which it does this is pretty much standard for men and women, tall people, small people, 50 milliliters per hour. There are effects on the absorption of the alcohol from the intestine, but the liver's work is pretty much at one speed. The liver, obviously, over time, suffers severely from this. We'll show more about that later. And then, of course, the blood goes to the brain and it brings the alcohol to the brain, where the functions of the brain are slowed down. So several centers of the brain are affected. First, there's a center that affects what we call rewards. It releases a chemical called dopamine, and you'll hear more about this. But it also controls our memory, our motor skills, our coordination, our vision, our hearing. So those are all the effects that comes when people are impaired, when they're walking, talking, driving, etc. With the alcohol use also comes inflammation in the pancreas. The pancreas's job is to release enzymes that helps you digest your food. Over time, you have less digestion, less absorption, and more inflammation in the pancreas, which leads to many serious issues with diabetes and jaundice. And then, of course, the last step is that the waste products are released from the body. They travel through the kidneys and into the urinary bladder. We have the same inflammatory process going on in the bladder, which can inhibit proper flow through the bladder. And if we don't have proper flow through the bladder, then we end up with too much backup of pressure and problems with the kidney function. So you can see that there's a lot of steps along the way where the effect is felt. So this is a summary that shows kind of where things are, and I want to point out, and there's two arrows up by the brain. So the top arrow here, the cerebellum, that's the part in the back of the brain that controls coordination. And that's why the sobriety tests include tests of coordination, of walking a line, of doing the various tasks with your hands and feet, because that's how the alcohol affects the brain. But also, there's the brainstem, the medulla, part of the brainstem, and that controls our day-to-day tasks that we don't think about, like our digestion and our breathing and our heart rate and even our consciousness. And this is why, without realizing that people can have enough alcohol, suddenly go to the brain, that they become unconscious or unresponsive. And this is the part that's the most feared, because, of course, if these centers aren't working anymore, you're not aware of it, and you need someone else to be there to save your life. So, I would like to use this example of somebody that's, you might say, unfortunately, a typical patient who I have to see. And we're going to start with an introduction, and then we're going to go through the body systems, and we'll show pictures. So an average patient, 68 years old, and the personal teaching that I received from treating these patients So first, simply, what effect is visible in the mouth? Obviously, the alcohol does damage to the protective layer of the teeth that builds up the plaque. The plaque is a thin film that produces the cavities where the bacteria comes in. And we also have a lot of tooth decay. So this is something that the dentist and the doctors worry about, because the next step in the mouth is that that chronic irritation leads to skin changes of the lining of the mouth. This is first seen with white patches in the mouth, but can progress to what we fear is the cancerous cells found in the throat, on the lining of the cheeks, or on the tongue. This is why in the States, I assume it's here the same as well, that it used to be when you went to the dentist and cleaned your teeth. Now when you go to the dentist, they examine your tongue and inside your mouth and everywhere, because we have to be so on the alert for these little slight changes of whiteness that could lead to an early diagnosis of cancer. So now that the alcohol is going down into the esophagus, the picture on the left, that's the picture of the inside of your esophagus normally. That's what a normal esophagus should look like. And then once the alcohol hits the stomach, that's the lining of the stomach normally. This is what it looks like when it's inflamed. When the esophagus is inflamed, and there's patches of white all the way down from top to bottom. And this is what it looks like in my patient. After years of inflammation in the stomach and in the liver, the blood vessels dilate, but the blood pressure backs up and we get big bleeding vessels in the stomach. And this leads to very serious bleeding into the stomach. Again, the damage is not immediate, it's a progression. So we go from healthy to fat deposits in the liver, and then we go to the very nodular, scarred, hard liver. And you can see in the cirrhosis, or the hardening of the liver, that clearly blood can't get through there, and that's why you see it backing up in the blood vessels back into the esophagus. And you have those big, large, dilated blood vessels that spontaneously bleed. And then as the patient progresses through that, we have a problem where that backup of blood and those vessels in the abdomen cause leaking of the fluid. And we have buildup of fluid in the abdomen. And that fluid has nowhere to go, so it just causes the abdomen to protrude. In addition, as the liver can't do its work, the yellow pigment builds up in the body, we call it jaundice, and you can see that in the skin and in the eyes. And then the blood vessels in the skin also dilate, so you often see the bright blood vessels in the face or in the extremities. Again, this is all a sign that not the damage is done today, but the damage has been done in the years in the past. So once you get to that point where the liver is scarred down, the only hope is a liver transplant. But the liver transplants do not go to the people where the liver damage was self-imposed. But there are liver transplants, and the amazing thing about the liver is that even a small piece of a liver transplanted into somebody can grow and do the work for the whole body. But once the whole liver is so far gone, there's no regeneration capability. So now let's talk about the brain. So here's two pictures. A 43-year-old on the left and a 43-year-old on the right. Clearly you can see the effect of aging, premature aging of the alcohol. And on the normal brain, you can see that there's a nice full brain with lots of folds where all of the neurons lie. And in the alcoholic, you can see that there's quite a bit of loss of volume, but also the folds are shrinking away. This is the toxic effect of the alcohol on the brain. And remember, it's not an 80-year-old, this is a 40-year-old. This is a different brain scan. This is where they actually take a picture of the brain while you're using it. So the brain can assign a color or an activity level to how much you're using your brain. So now we have 15-year-olds, and we're taking a picture of how they're using the brain, what parts of it they're using. And they found that this is not somebody who's drunk for 30 years. This is somebody who's having episodes of binge drinking. Binge here is defined as one or two heavy drinking episodes per month, heavy meaning four or five drinks.
So you can see the 15-year-old who's able to use the brain normally has a bright pattern of activity spread in a good portion of the brain at once. And when this task was given to these people, they could see that the brain was being used. And they gave the same task to the person who had these 4 to 5 drinks at a time, a few times a month. They could see that it was very difficult for that person to engage their brain. So again, this is a functional study that says, yes, there is no doubt that we are seriously impairing the ability to use our brain properly when we use alcohol, even in an intermittent fashion. I'm going to introduce the concept of the reward center, and Tom Flight will go deeper into that. This is very critical to understand. Even at the basic level, it helps us understand all addictions. So in the brain, we are given what we call the reward center. And this is the thing that is set up to produce a need or a desire. To have a desire to have that met, which is called the reward. The reward gives us that feeling of happiness or contentment for a time. And then we have withdrawal because the reward is now done. And then we have craving because we remember what that's like and we'd like it again. And then we go seek out that reward again. So this is built in. This is not a pathological thing. This is a good thing. But that's the way we are made. So there's part of the brain called the reward center. And it talks to the centers that give us our motivation. But it also talks to us in the frontal part of the brain where we make decisions and helps guide us in our behaviors. So these slides are for the children, but you'll understand it too. So we think about what is that reward feeling like? So I just threw up some examples. So some people have that feeling when they're listening to music that's very familiar, very comforting. And other people have it when they see that. They kind of know what that feeling is. And know what that bite is going to taste like before they taste it, and then they think about that piece that's left in the fridge that they're going to have tomorrow. You know what I mean? So you're catching this. And others respond to this, right? So they're thinking about that last nice piece of beef that they had. And some people understand what that feeling is when they have a faithful pet, or some people enjoy baking in the kitchen together as a family, and all the sights and smells and sounds that go with it. But all of these things trigger the rewards. And for all of us, it's different. We all have different triggers. Here's another reward center. Now that you understand this cycle, like, this is so great, I just can't stop myself. And then about a half hour later, never again, right? I'm not going back. But this is a cycle. And this is going to bring us to the second addiction that I want to talk a little bit about. This is, again, from personal experience in my practice. Okay? So now we're talking about a different addiction. But what I want you to do is let's not focus so much on the person, but let's think about what's underlying. Okay, so this is an example. This is not my patient, but this is a real person who wanted to go public to teach people about addictions and gave permission to use her story. So we need to look beyond the outward appearance and say, what brings us here? So, of course, the first instinct we all have is, well, of course, it's how she eats. Look what she eats. Certainly, that's where the problem lies. And then we start thinking a little bit more. Maybe people have addictions because they don't have friends. Maybe they feel isolated. Maybe they have the wrong kind of friends. Or maybe it's her self-esteem. Maybe we need to boost her self-esteem somehow. So these are the things that we've all been taught. And I think that in this story that she shared, we learn a lot more when we go back. There's always a story behind the story. So let's talk about genetics. How do we determine genetics? Well, her mother's in the picture. Her mother's not obese. Her sister's in the picture. Her sister doesn't look obese. But the story she tells is that she had medical struggles when she was young. She had asthma. She spent many days and weeks in the hospital. She was confined to an oxygen tent, so was not out playing with her friends. She was lonely. And then when she was well enough to come home, then suddenly there was all the medical bills. And suddenly both her parents left the house to work to pay the medical bills. And she said that she was alone for many hours, and food was her comfort. Food was her friend. Now think about this. This is a young girl who's missing something in her home, and food became a friend.
Her parents are hardworking, but they were absent. She's alone, she's feeling left out. By 10 years old, she was 45 kilos. And she said, food became the replacement for her security and her comfort. And she said, food was my hug. So her hug was her reward center. And without realizing it, that became her reward system. So, now at this point, when we meet this person in the store or in the hospital, is it helpful to point out that she's overweight? Is it helpful to say she needs to go on a diet or she needs to get on the treadmill? Is it fair to even expect her to be able to do this? These are the things that we need to see. So when we see the person, we often quickly create the situation in our mind that must have caused it. But we need to have compassion for the fact that at the heart of it, her reward center needs to be understood. And then from there, we can make the adjustments. So this is the way I usually see them because they come to me in my office. And of course, the conversation usually goes like this. Doctor, you have to do something. That's usually the way it's presented, right? And so I just sit there and I look across the room and remember, Mom's sitting here. And we remember what Mom used to look like. So the picture is complicated because we have family dynamics. And perhaps there's another issue here with the rewards, because in order for her to have a problem with her obesity, they don't think she's going to the grocery store and doing her own shopping, right? So somebody has to provide food and to set up the structure and to give her the encouragement to do better and to help her and to get medical care. And it looks like that we need to talk about the whole family unit. So this is where the discussions come in about, is there a medical problem? Is there a way medically we can help? But also we have to go back to understand what is the situation behind the situation. So certainly we need to show pity, sympathy towards the patient and the family. But we also needed to talk frankly with her caregivers, because now she can't care for herself, about how do we get her out of the situation. Who is allowing her to stay in this situation, or who put her in this situation? Not to guess blame, but to understand the addiction. And then we create an action plan. For the patient? No. We create an action plan for the whole situation. So it's the caregivers, it's the people who have to plan her meals for her. And of course, at this point, there are many medical complications that need a team to help with. So again, I don't want to focus on obesity per se, but I want to say it's an addiction, just like all of the many addictions that we face. And we cannot address it by saying that the person is the problem, or that the alcohol is the problem, or the food is the problem, right? Because in many ways, food is a much more difficult addiction, because we all have to have food. And so it becomes that lesson that we have to use wisely, because it can cause so much harm if it's not. And so to transition back to alcohol, it's easy, especially I think our children do this, as they look at that picture and what leaps out at them is the food, and they say, well, look at all that horrible food. Who has three pizzas? You know, that must be the problem. But how is it any different if our children walked in and looked at this next picture? Clearly, if they walked in and saw this picture, they'd say, well, it's that evil alcohol. But we don't want to leave you with that picture, because we've already said that if used properly and biblically, you do not have to see it as evil. It's the contributing factors behind it. And so with that, I'm going to have Tom bring us through those contributing factors.